Appalachia, it's about relationships. And so it's not bringing in the specialists from the outside. It's about the people who grew up there actually touching the people with the gospel who live there. It's serving them, knowing them. You know, Appalachian people are very proud people. They love to serve and give even when they don't have it to give. So you create opportunities within your church to create a culture where they can give, and then you connect the gospel to that.
From Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute, this is the Level Paths Podcast. We're glad you've taken some time to join us. My name is Chris Weigel. There is one word in the list of Christian vocabulary words that makes some people break out in a cold sweat. That word is evangelism. Why is it so off-putting? Well, there are several reasons, and the problem is, none of the reasons are good ones. On this episode of the Level Paths Podcast, we are counting down to April 29th. It's the date for this year's Appalachian Ministry Conference at Tri-State Bible College in South Point, Ohio, and the title for this year's conference is, as it turns out, Evangelism in Appalachia. Jesus clearly told his followers to go out into the world and tell people about him. And this April 29th, every aspect of how to do just that in the Appalachian region will be addressed. Church planting, church cooperation, indifference to the gospel, migration as missions, and many other topics will help pastors and church leaders in their efforts to reach Appalachians with the gospel. You'll hear from several breakout speakers, and the keynote speaker is Dr. David Wheeler from Liberty University. And of course, Rex Howe and Dr. Matt Shamblin, the host of this podcast, will be at the conference as well, and you can meet them in person and learn much more about the Appalachian Ministry Institute and Tri-State Bible College. The Appalachian Ministry Conference is again coming up on April 29th at Tri-State Bible College in South Point, Ohio. To find out more, visit tsbc.edu. And as I previously mentioned, Dr. David Wheeler from Liberty University is the keynote speaker at the Appalachian Ministry Conference, and he's the guest on this episode of the Level Paths Podcast. Here's Rex.
Welcome back to another Level Paths Podcast. My name is Rex Howe. I serve as the president of Tri-State Bible College. And as always, I'm here with my colleague and my friend, Dr. Matt Shamblin. Matt, it has been a wet and wild time here in North Central Appalachia.
Rex, has been pretty crazy, as we see on the news, houses floating down the river and things like that in the capital of Kentucky. But right now, things are wet in our part of the woods, but they're not flooding this time, thank God. Rex, right. I'm really excited about our guest today, Dr. David Wheeler. Dr. David Wheeler is on faculty at Liberty University. He's going to be our keynote speaker at our Appalachian Ministry Conference. He was one of my favorite professors in seminary, and he has become a dear friend. Dr. Wheeler, it's great to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. It's good to be here with you.
Tell us a little bit about your education, your background, your experience in ministry.
I'm from Tennessee. Originally, I was born in Oak Ridge, East Tennessee, raised in Nashville. I'm not sure we can spell education, but we'll try our best to do it. But I went to college at Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville, Tennessee. Was an education major in college and social science and psychology minor. Went to Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas for the master's and finished the PhD program in 1994 in evangelism under the tutelage of Dr. Roy Fish, Dr. Malcolm McDowell, Dr. James Eaves, those men. And so just had a great time. I've been in ministry a little over 40 years. I started preaching when I was 17. I remember telling my grandmother when I was about 10 years old, they asked me one night, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I think I want to be a preacher. And they looked at me like, what? Because I can promise you my teachers in elementary school didn't think I was going to be a preacher for sure. And for some reason, I just felt the call of my life. Now, I ran from that for a long time. I didn't answer that call, actually, until I was about 20 years old. Anyway, I pastored my first church as an interim when I was 22 years old. Moved to Fort Worth. My wife and I spent some time in Burkina Faso, West Africa, Sam Wabo Project with Tennessee Baptist Convention. And then we moved to Fort Worth, Texas, one seminary, and I pastored a church in Bonham, Texas, and then one up outside of McKinney, Texas. I became the evangelism director for the Indiana Southern Baptist Convention from 1992, 93 to 99, then went Southwestern taught church planning and evangelism for a little while, and then went back as evangelism director in Ohio. I think that's when we met, when I was in Ohio as evangelism director there. And then I came here to Liberty as a professor of evangelism in 2006. And since then, I've served as assistant director of the Center for Ministry Training, as executive director of the Center for Ministry Training, and now the senior executive director of our LU Shepherd office. I get to serve as one of our, under our chancellor, Jonathan Falwell, who I love dearly. I get to serve on a team with some other guys as one of our campus pastors, and love to get to do that. I'll be finished up 19 years in July and teach evangelism. And I was counting this, I teach these large classes, a little over 50,000 students in my time since I've been here. So a lot of students.
That is incredible. You said a name I want to circle back on, because he is a name of legend when it comes to evangelism in the Southern Baptist Convention, and that is Dr. Roy Fish. What was it that made Dr. Fish so incredible? Anybody who is evangelistic and who's been through Southwestern Seminary refers to Dr. Fish. Why is that?
Well, he and Dr. McDowell were mentors of mine. I mean, Dr. McDowell's still alive and that kind of thing, and I love him dearly. We talk quite often. He's 89 now. Dr. Fish, I had him for my first class when I went into seminary, and we just got to know each other. You know, he was one of the ones that helped me get into the PhD program. He was just a mentor. When my wife got sick back in 1989, he had been through a lot. And I remember this snapshot should give you a really good picture of who he is. She was really sick. Her lungs were bleeding. They had her in respiratory care. She was 6 months pregnant with our youngest daughter. They didn't expect either one of them hardly to live. And then they found out that Debbie had a blood clot, and they had to emergency surgery on her that Friday. I'll never forget this. Dr. Fish showed up. Dr. Eve showed up. Dr. Fish's son, Steve, who's a good friend, they showed up. And Dr. Fish was just sitting there rocking back and forth, and he wasn't saying a whole lot. I said, Dr. Fish, what's going on? He looked at me, and this is what he said, just very directly. He said, do you know anything about spiritual warfare? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, you're going to learn. He said, where can we find a room to go pray? So we went and found a room down the hall, and we began to pray. And we prayed for probably a couple hours. And I mean, heaven just came down in that room. And Dr. Fish's son, Steve, looked at me and he said, now I want you to go in there, lay your hands on Debbie, and just pray over every molecule of her body before she goes into surgery. Because about an hour after I prayed for her, by the way, the anesthesiologist told me, Mr. Wheeler, she's the most unstable patient I've ever worked on. She has a much better chance of dying before she ever gets back to this room, because she was really sick. So I went in there and prayed over her. When I finished up that prayer, probably 45 minutes of praying over all of her, I put my hand on top of her hand. She squeezed my hand. She was totally comatose. There's no way she could have squeezed my hand. And Dr. Fish would show back up, you know, and pray with us and just teach us how to do that. And greatest prayer meeting I've ever been a part of. He taught our seminar on spiritual awakenings. I taught the seminar here on spiritual awakenings at Liberty. I would interview him every time I taught the seminar because he was just phenomenal. I mean, he just lived that out. That was just the kind of guy he was. He knew Jerry Falwell. He knew Billy Graham. He knew all these guys. He was humble, loving, caring, cared for souls. Just a good guy. Now, I'm going to tell you something. He wasn't one who put up with a lot of foolishness, but it was fun at the same time. I talked to him about 6 days before he died. You know, I just told him then, I said, Roy, I said, I want you to know, you will never die as long as we keep teaching what you taught us. And I've told Dr. McDowell this over and over again, same way. There's no way you could possibly understand how much you have meant to my life. As I say that, I get real emotional because this is the truth. I have a picture right here next to my desk of Dr. Fish and Dr. McDowell. And I look at those every day because it reminds me that one day there's going to be one of my students who's going to be looking back. And the question I want them to ask is, what did I learn from him? What was that? And probably whatever I taught them, they taught me. Dr. Fish was just a phenomenal, loving, gracious, kind guy. His wife, Jean, sweet as she could be. His son, Steve, one of the greatest prayer warriors I've ever known in my life. Just amazing human being, but loved evangelism, loved souls, man.
Amen. Amen. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I'd love to hear more, but we need to shift gears as we're talking about the evangelism conference or the Appalachian Ministry Conference. And it's amazing. I just said evangelism conference. I haven't planned one of those in years, but you and I always talked when we were planning those.
That's exactly right.
Your PhD is in evangelism. Dr. Fish and Dr. McDowell, they were in evangelism. So why does evangelism matter?
Well, because I think it's the heart of God. Jesus said, I came to seek and to save those that are lost. From Genesis to Revelation, from the moment that sin enters the world, you know, immediately God says, I'm going to put a seed of enmity between thee and me. In other words, the very message of the rest of Scripture from Genesis to Revelation is redemption. And evangelism is the propagation of the message of redemption. It is the call of who we're supposed to be. And so why does it matter? It matters because, you know, has someone not evangelized me, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. If someone hadn't evangelized you, you wouldn't be having this conversation. It matters because souls matter, because people matter. I mean, here we are about to go into the, you know, into Palm Sunday and to Easter, the highest time of the year, you know, where Jesus marched in and laid his life down willingly for us. So, I mean, if he did that so that souls may be saved, and the propagation of the gospel is what evangelism is, if it mattered to Jesus, it should matter to us. And it certainly mattered to Jesus. I have guys who want to argue about that all the time. Well, you know, I'm more of a disciple maker than I am an evangelist. Let me just say this. If you're not a disciple maker and an evangelist, you're neither. Because you're not going to make any disciples without evangelism. And by the way, upon the purpose of evangelism, it's part of the discipleship process. The purpose of discipleship is to help the evangelized eventually become evangelizers so they can be multiplying disciples themselves, or they're not full disciples. People say, are you saying I'm not a disciple? Listen, I'm not saying anything. I'm simply just saying to this, that evangelism should be as much a part of discipleship as discipleship should be a part of evangelism. You help someone come to Christ, then you disciple them to become multipliers of the gospel so other people can come to Christ, so they can disciple other people. That's what multiplication's all about. I use an example in our Great Commission Worship book where it talks about volcanoes. And when I was a kid, they make those volcanoes, you know, you put the baking soda at the bottom of it. Well, if you put that baking soda down at the bottom of it and you leave it there, it's not going to do anything. That's what most happens in our church. We do fellowship without multiplication. We do discipleship without multiplication. We do worship without this. We do prayer without this. But without the catalyst of multiplication and evangelism, what happens when you pour that vinegar? That vinegar is that catalyst. It explodes and goes out everywhere. Well, that's what evangelism is. It's that catalyst that takes prayer from just praying for your people there, for prayer being not passive, but being active where you pray for people outside of that. It takes fellowship from being just putting a bunch of Christians together to us actually bringing other people lost into that so they can see how the church operates. Why? Because they need community too. And maybe out of that, they can know Christ. It takes ministry from just mowing our neighbor, our person's yard in our church, or several of the snow of the persons in our church, to actually doing this out in the community so people can know Christ. It takes every part of that, worship, everything, and it ignites it. That's what it's all about.
You can hear the passion for evangelism in Dr. Wheeler, and that's exactly what we wanted to communicate at the Appalachian Ministry Conference this year.
Is there a favorite story in the New Testament about like an evangelistic story that just really excites you?
There's quite a few, but probably my favorite that I've told the most is John 4 with the woman at the well. And the reason why I love that so much is because it puts every piece together. You got Jesus who's standing there with the disciples who are normally going to walk all the way around Samaria, but yet he intentionally chooses to put himself there where lost people are, which bottom line is we have a lot of folks who don't want to intentionally put themselves there because we choose to put ourselves in our comfortable places in our church buildings, or we cushion ourselves from the lost people around us. No, Jesus dove right in the middle of this. And then where does he go? He goes to the well. And this woman comes walking to the well, her head's uncovered and all these kind of things. And he starts to speak to her. And she says, why do you speak to me? For you're a Jew, and Jews don't speak to Samaritans, particularly a Samaritan woman. And I love the old story. A old story I heard years ago. Tony Evans talked about this at a Promise Keepers conference. He was using this example. He said, he looks at her and he says to her, he says, give me a drink. And she says, why would you speak to me? Why was he asking her to give him a drink? Because he had nothing to draw with. That's, we found out that from the context. So what was he really saying? He's saying, listen, you got a bucket there. You got a dipper there. Why don't you get some water? I drink from the same dipper that you drink from. And so you know, Tony Evans pointed out, and I think this is beautiful. He says, guys, the racial tension in our culture will be healed if we would all be willing to drink from the same dipper. I walked through this in my class. We wrote this in a book called Evangelism Is, the Evangelism of Jesus, you know, what he does and how Jesus step by step by step by step, finally, he points out the woman's sin, and eventually he reveals himself to this woman, you know, who he really is. Oh, you're the one. Wow, you're the one I've been waiting for. And then I love this. The first thing she wants to do is go back into that town to the very people who have made fun of her, the women who despised her because she may have been with her husband, and the men who didn't respect her. And the first thing she wanted to do was go back and tell the town so those people could know Jesus. And by the way, here's the kicker to me, is that in our culture today, we would tell that woman, you get back here. You've not been through our new members class yet. You don't really know what you're supposed to. No, he just let her go. I love the fact he sent her out there. Go tell others what I've done for you. She drew all those people out there, and a couple of days later, they're all saying, hey, we're not here anymore because of this woman. We're here because we know that you are the savior of the world, because the gospel is that powerful, you know. And so to me, that's probably one of my favorite stories.
That is excellent. So what do you see? You're in a lot of churches and have got a lot of connections with churches, travel and speak a lot. What do you see in churches who are evangelizing well?
It starts with the pastor. It starts with the staff. It starts with the deacons. It starts with the leadership of the church. It starts with the small group Sunday school teachers. It starts with them, because it starts with that youth pastor who's not just going to try to pull people there on a Wednesday night or a Sunday night. He's going to teach his students how to take the gospel back to the marketplace in their school. Like, I've always thought it interesting that we get upset because the prayer's not in schools anymore, but we got students in school, right? You know, we all probably wish they still had prayer in schools, but that's not the issue. The issue is we got Christian students in school, right? When I was in Texas, they go, we got all these gated communities. We can't. Wait a minute, you got church members in those communities, don't you? You should have the gospel in that community. I mean, listen, as long as they have tests in schools, they're going to have prayer, right? So, I mean, those kids are going to pray. And so, to me, I think it starts from the pastor setting forth and laying this out there and giving examples of how you're doing this. And it catches. I remember doing an interim one time in Cincinnati. They had a certain time of the service that they did a certain thing every Sunday morning. To me, it just really wasn't effective. So I took about 5 to 7 minutes every Sunday morning. And I started out at first, and I would say, listen, guys, every Sunday, I want to share a story with you. A story of someone I've met this week, maybe that you can pray for, someone I've got to share with. And so the first week was about a guy that was pulled over next to Dayton, you know, outside of Dayton in a construction zone. He ran out of gas, and I picked him up and took him up to a gas station. And while he was going inside of the bathroom, I filled up his gas tank for him. I filled up his gas can for him and everything. He couldn't believe that. When he came back out to the car, we began to share. I knew I only had about 5 minutes. I said, listen, I want to ask you a question. What kind of spiritual beliefs do you have? And he asked me why I would do this. I got to share the gospel with him. And as God would have it, this guy got saved on the side of the interstate there. In a construction zone. Come to find out, he lived 20 minutes from my church over in Columbus. And so I told the church that. And the next week, I told him another story about something else happened. Maybe a neighbor, somebody that we ministered to. Maybe they didn't get saved. Maybe it was just us planting a seed or whatever. And here's what I started noticing. After about 4 or 5 weeks, people started lining up after the service to tell me their stories. Because when they were hearing their leadership saying, this is what I want us to do, then they would reflect that back. So I think the most important thing to me, it's not that we don't know how to share the gospel, because we got 100 different ways. Man, I got 4 or 5 apps on my phone where I can show you videos of how to share the gospel. The story, the 3 circles, there's all kinds of them that we can do that, you know? Share your faith app. The issue is not that we don't have enough approaches. The issue is we just don't train our people. I think what we've done is we've allowed this whole idea, and it goes back to discipleship. We disciple people how to be good church members, not how to be multiplying disciples. For me, for instance, you know, I think most of our discipleship is linear. You know, we get saved, so we teach you how to be a good church member. You need your spiritual gifts inventory. How do you pray? How do you tithe? How do you do it? And all those things are important. But 40 years later, we've never taught you how to share your faith. Cyclical discipleship is you get saved and we ask you, give me 5 names of people right now that you know that don't know Christ. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to start praying for them. And the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to help you learn to do your testimony. You pick out one of those people, and you and I are going to go visit them. And guess what we're going to do? We're going to go visit those people, visit that person, and I'm going to ask you to share your testimony, and I'm going to share the gospel so that new Christian gets to hear me share the gospel. So I get to disciple him through the gospel, and he gets to learn his testimony. So immediately it becomes his multiplication. In churches that I see that are growing like that, evangelism is not just talked about, it's actually expected. It's a culture that's built of, we want to see people come to Christ. It's not, I don't have, you know, that's not my thing. That's the church's thing. It's not built around a bunch of church events and programs. It's built around God's people being multipliers in and of themselves. I'm going to share at that conference, Prayer Care Share. Prayer Care Share is a book that Dave Early and I wrote this last couple of years. It's a great philosophy. You begin to pray for lost people. You care for lost people. You share with lost people. It's built around the harvest principles. It's real simple. Anybody can do that. You keep a list of lost people. You have a list of lost people you pray for that don't know Christ. And then when's the last time you actually shared the gospel with that person? So to me, it starts with the leadership of the church and what we do. You know, it starts with us as pastors, as ministers, modeling that and then teaching our people how to do it. And by the way, expecting them to do that. You know, like when I do deacon ordinations, this may sound crazy to people, but first question I'm going to ask is, tell me the last time you shared your faith. Tell me the last time you saw someone come to Christ. If they can't answer those, I'm not going to ordain them. Why would I want to ordain somebody to lead our people to not doing what they're not doing? I mean, come on. If you don't have a love for the gospel, how can you have a love for his church, right? And so I think we need to expect this from our folks. We need to teach them how they can do it. My daughter, you know this, man. My youngest daughter has mild cerebral palsy. She just got back from the Philippines, sharing the gospel in the Philippines. And one night at a camp over there, she and a bunch of our students at the camp, they had over 300 people come to Christ, and every one of our students leading people to Christ. And so was she with a speech impediment. We never told her, you can't share the gospel. We said, no, you need to do this. It's not because she has some special gift. It's because she just has a passion for the gospel. We need to lay that out for our people and train our people to do that. We are the keys to that, I think, as leaders.
Amen.
You talked about, what do you see in churches who evangelize? What starts at the top, telling stories of evangelistic conversation? There's plenty of resources out there. We just got to train the people. We got to train them to be multipliers. How would you say you cultivate an evangelistic culture? How do you cultivate that in your personal life, but then also in the church, specifically Appalachian churches?
Well, I've grown up in Tennessee. I'm familiar with Appalachia. My family all came from Appalachia itself. And so relationships matter in Appalachia. Yeah. They do. I mean, people coming in from the outside aren't going to reach them. You bring an evangelist. I mean, Billy Graham could have went in the middle when he was younger, in the middle of Appalachia, and half the people wouldn't have come because they didn't know his cousins. You know what I mean? They weren't kin to them. They didn't know him. Bottom line is, Appalachia is about relationship. And so it's not bringing in a specialist from the outside. It's about the people who grew up there actually touching the people with the gospel who live there. It's serving them, knowing them. You know, Appalachian people are very proud people. They love to serve and give, even when they don't have it to give. So you create opportunities within your church to create a culture where they can give, and then you connect the gospel to that. It's like, we're going to help people out. If a tornado comes through and someone's house gets hurt, man, people in Appalachia, they're going to come help each other. Particularly if they grew up with those people, they know those people. That's what they're going to do. They're going to be a part of all that. Part of what we have to do is really build into this an expectation that as we're serving, we're going to share the gospel. This idea of preaching the gospel, if necessary, using words, is not biblical. It's not even rational. I mean, how can people know unless we share with them the extra words of the gospel itself? You build a culture. I would start with the book of Acts, for instance. Every time I go do an interim, I start preaching through the book of Acts. Acts chapter 1, you have people going up and they're praying. Acts chapter 2, you have the Holy Spirit. End of Acts chapter 2, you have them going door to door. They're serving and they're sharing, and he's added to the church daily those who are being saved. Acts chapter 3, they preach and 3,000 people come to Christ. Acts chapter 4, the religious leaders are coming down on Peter and John. And what do? They say, listen, as for us, we cannot stop speaking what we've seen and heard. You just keep going. You get to Acts chapter 8, you know, Acts chapter 7 with Stephen and the dispersion of the people going. You know, you get to Acts chapter 8 and you have Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch sharing the gospel there. You know, preach through that. You get to Acts chapter 9, you got Paul. Acts chapter 10, you got Peter. It's all about the gospel. Yeah. Taking the gospel out. And they're doing it in their culture, where they are, how it best fits them. You know, servant evangelism is going to look a little bit different probably in Appalachia than it does. Like, for instance, if you're going to do a free car wash in Appalachia, it may be a free truck wash, right? Or free tractor wash. Who knows? How many of those small communities out there, I know this because I remember this happening in Ohio. Bring your tractor to school day. You know what I'm talking about.
When I was state director of evangelism in West Virginia, we had a church that was just across the border in Ohio. And I drove up and was there and stopped at a gas station one morning to kind of get prepared to go over to the church. And I called my wife. I said, you're not going to believe this. She said, what's that? I said, I think I'm going to be late to the church because I timed it just perfectly that I was behind literally a tractor parade on Saturday or Sunday morning. And they had, the truth of the matter is, probably the most expensive thing that had driven on that road that day was those tractors.
Yeah. You know, Matt, I remember a friend of mine in Ohio who told me this story. He pastored a church down in South, we've been Southeast Ohio, down in Appalachia, man. And we were talking about servant vans. And he called me one day and said, I got to tell you what happened. He said, we had this lady in our church that she's not very wealthy. He said she lived in a community of about 35 homes, and they were all small, probably mostly manufactured homes. And she wanted to do something to help her neighbors because she'd heard him talk about servant evangelism. And so she went to the grocery store to find something that everybody needed, and all she could find was toilet paper. So she literally went door to door and gave people toilet paper, you know, and said, now, during COVID, that would have been really useful, you know. But she went door to door, and she said out of about 35 men, probably 20 of them were really responsive. So she baked cookies and took them back to those people and ministered to them. And they would take them from her because she lived in their community. They didn't need a preacher come from the outside. They just needed her to take the gospel to them. Appalachia is all about relationships. I know that. My dad used to take me up in all those houses and shaking people's hands and walking around and doing all that kind of stuff. It's all about building relationships with people. It's about sitting down and eating with them. You know, I mean, literally, Appalachia, you'll fry anything, man. You know, it's the truth. You know, if you don't like banana pudding, man, you just need to move to New York City. You know what I mean? I'm telling you. They love families. They love each other. They respect that. And think about this. Evangelism was meant to be a relational activity in the first place. So it should fit Appalachia perfectly, right? And it's all, how do we do? How do we connect prayer, care, share, the Appalachian context? That's really what it's about.
Well, Doc, it's been great having this conversation with you today. And that should be enough to whet the appetites of those who are coming to the Appalachian Ministry Conference. You know, this is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you come and this year focus on evangelism. Because at one time, I'm told that Appalachia was one of the most evangelized places in the nation. And now the rate of church attendance mirrors that which is in the Northeast. And so we've got to get back to the task of evangelism. And that's why we wanted to have that focus this year with our Appalachian Ministry Conference. Well, Rex, I knew it was going to be good. I knew it would be good having Dr. Wheeler on here. He's not the first guy who's talked about prayer, care, share with us. We had Dr. Dave Early, the other author of that book. We've had him talk about that very thing as well. I love both of these men. They have had an incredible impact on my life. And I'm talking about the good parts, not the bad parts. We'll blame that on somebody else. Well, Doc, thank you for your time today. And we so look forward to having you on April the 29th at the Appalachian Ministry Conference right there on the campus of Tri-State Bible College.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. God bless you, and I look forward to being there with you.
Prayer, care, share. They all rhyme, but how do we put legs on prayer, care, share, and how does it relate to evangelism in Appalachia? Well, Dr. David Wheeler will answer that and many more questions at the Appalachian Ministry Conference. And if you are a reasonable distance from South Point, Ohio, and you want to attend the conference, simply visit tsbc.edu for more information on how you can be there. Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute exist as a resource, and no matter what need you may have, Rex Howe and Dr. Matt Shamlin want you to reach out to them today. Rex Howe is the president of Tri-State Bible College, and you can contact him by email at rex.howe@tsbc.edu. And you can reach out to Dr. Matt Shamlin at the Appalachian Ministry Institute by email, matt.shamlin@tsbc.edu. The Level Paths Podcast is an outreach of Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute.